Again, it's good to see you. Again, thank you to Van. As we are in the midst of the flood, God has sent his deluge onto the world. Do you have any questions about chapter 7 that maybe were lingering questions or something that came up in the week that you would like to bring up? Yes, ma'am.
I was just thinking about the way that Noah put everything on, how God had raised the waters.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody really thought about the reason there wasn't any windows in the ark? Is the Lord didn't want to burden them or for them to see what was happening?
So as far as biblically speaking, I don't think there's anything biblically speaking that tells us exactly the reason for it. I know there's lots of information out there on different topics like that. I haven't really studied that myself, so I would be speaking about something I haven't really looked at. But Apology Express is a great resource. There's others out there that do a lot of good work in this way. As far as the windows question, I'm not quite certain. And of course, there's some diversity of thought about the window itself and whether it was one kind of window that wrapped around or whether it was just one window. I think the text there has enough ambiguity in it to not even be able to say exactly what it looked like. Yes, ma'am.
Windows might not have been able to withstand the pressure.
And that's the thing, too. I mean, you think about the construction of the ship itself, the
first
boat.
First didn't have glass back then.
Yeah. There wasn't that super thick glass that you have in ships today where they can put them all over the boat. That's true. These were open windows, if you will. Good question. Any others? All right. So I'm going to go on and move into chapter 8. If you have something that pops in your mind, I don't mind looking at it together. But let's go on and let's move into the first part of chapter 8. So as we're looking at the text there, the text tells us that verse 1, but God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. I think it's an interesting way that opens, right? God remembered Noah. Is there any thought that God forgot about Noah? No. What do you think that, using that term remember, what might that denote?
It is about time.
Okay, about time. God does things in perfect time, and it was the time had fully arrived.
Maybe God remembered Noah because Noah had remembered him.
Yeah. So in a kind of symbolic sense, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a contrast of the end of the previous chapter when all the land animals died.
Okay. So you're saying...
the end of 6.
End of 6.
23.
Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him. Is that...
Yeah, the last paragraph starts with 23. So he destroyed all living things which are on the face of the ground, both man and cattle.
Okay.
Created things and birds of the air.
But Noah took special attention for him. And he didn't do that with him. Yeah. I was looking at the Hebrew there. There's really not anything necessarily that jumps out at you in looking at the original language, but it is this idea of being mindful. It is to remember, to be remembered, to bring, or to put into remembrance. So you think about the ways it can be translated, you know, to think of, to remember, to be brought to mind. Those are the kind of ideas that he's bringing up there. Well, God took special note of Noah, and I do think it does go back to chapter 6, the very last verse. What does the text tell us? Noah did all that God had commanded him, and he took special note of that. If you go all the way back to verse 8 of chapter 6, of course, there it says, Noah's faith caught God's special attention. Did you have something, Miss Lynn? Oh, I don't know. I didn't want to be like an auctioneer where you got to be careful with what hand you raise and how you raise it. You might get called on. But the text says in verse 1, God remembered Noah. He took special note of him and every living thing. So it's at this point, the text says, end of verse 1, that God made a wind to pass over the earth and the waters receded, that they began to fall away. Now, if we're looking at kind of a time frame, how long has Noah been on the ark? Since the very first raindrops, how much time have we seen? No, a little longer than that. 150 days, right? So you had 40 days of solid rain. And it's interesting in the Hebrew there, that word, it talks about rain coming down. That rain, it denotes the idea of a fierce rain, right? You know the difference between a light shower and a heavy thunderstorm. If you've ever been outside and you've seen or experienced a thunderstorm come through and how quickly it can, and just the amount of water that drops, right? So when Noah was on the ark for those first 40 days, he's experiencing this heavy downfall. Well, that stopped at 40 days. Then what happens? Well, then the waters continue to rise. So just because it's not raining doesn't mean the waters aren't continuing to rise. They continue to rise for how long? About 110 days. And then it's at that climax that things begin to recede, and they begin to come down. All right, looking back at the text there, so he's been on there for a while, but he's still not out yet, right? The fountains of the deep, says verse 2, and the windows of heaven were closed. All of that stopped, and the waters receded from the earth continually. And at the end of 150 days, the waters had abated. So it's at that 150 mark that they're not going to rise any higher. Now, how high have they gotten? I don't know why I had trouble getting that word out. How high have they gotten to?
They cover all land.
Cover all land. How does the Bible describe it? It covered what?
The mountain.
The highest peaks, right? I don't know why we debate this. I know there's some ambiguity in the Hebrew about some people try to argue for a local flood. But there's some notes in that text where, to me, this is a worldwide event. Now, especially when you get to the New Testament and you see the way Jesus speaks about the flood, you see the way Peter speaks about it in his writing, there's no doubt that the world was completely deluged and it wasn't some local event. But that water had reached the highest peak. Now, one thing we have to remember, though, are the mountains we have today the same as were before the flood? No. We have no idea how high the highest mountain was. We know how high the mountains are today. We can look at like Mount Everest, and we can do some calculations, and we know kind of the height. We know the height. But at that time, because of what God is doing in bringing the flood, the topography of the earth has changed immensely. The world that Noah and his family are going to walk off onto and all the animals is not the same place they left behind. It's very different. And so the water has now begun to recede. And verse number 4 tells us that in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. Where's Mount Ararat at? Well, we don't know exactly. We have some guesses. And Mount Ararat probably, I'm getting away from the microphone, but probably referred to a mountain range, not a particular mountain, right? So we're looking at a range now.
what is believed to be are somewhere in amongst this range of mountains is possibly. Now, people have spent countless hours or countless amounts of money and time trying to find this ark. I've always thought wood rots. I don't know why we're looking so hard. But it was on some mountain called Mount Ararat that that the ark came to rest. Yes, sir.
Where did he get on?
It was in the land of Ur, so if that's the same Ur, again, the topography has changed tremendously. So Ur is in this general area.
It could be Iraq.
But it's down here. There's Haran, and I believe Ur is like here. Ur is where Babylon would arise from, right? If those match up, then it would have been somewhere here. If that is the case, what's interesting is he didn't travel very far.
Or he could have gone around the world.
That's true. Well, let me say it this way. His beginning point and his destination are not far apart. I don't know how far he traveled, but again, the ark wasn't made to go anywhere here. It was just made to do one thing, float, to rise, right? So he lands in Mount Ararat. I saw one scholar look at this and they said, you think of Armenia. That's kind of the general area they thought. Some think that the ship settled in. Not really that important or significant. If you go down to verse 6, well, verse 5 tells you it was... he was eventually able to see the top of the mountains. Can you imagine what that day must have felt like? You've been on there for a while. And now things, it's getting to recede. But that first mountain peak, that had to be pretty exciting to see that. You kind of really feel like, okay. You ever been on a ride? You all like riding rides at the amusement parks, right? You ever get on a ride that kind of scares you and you're ready to be done? I recently did that. I did the mountain roller coaster thing. Kind of interesting. It was kind of fun, but I was kind of ready to be done. When I finally saw the end of that, I was kind of okay, right? And here he is. It's near the end. Things, you can tell the waters are beginning to recede. There's evidence of that. Verse 6 tells us, beginning there, he opens up the window and he sends out two birds, a raven and a dove. They go out. First he sends the raven. It says it went to and fro until the waters dried up from the earth. The raven doesn't come back. He also sent a dove. The dove does come back. First time it has nothing. The second time, what happens? What does it bring back with it? What was it? Olive leaf, right? It has the olive leaf in its beak, which is kind of significant. Why is that important?
Olive trees are not very big.
Okay, they're not very big.
Pretty close to the ground.
But the leaf itself, what does that tell you? What?
It's growing.
Growing, you've got vegetation. That's kind of significant. So it brings that back. And then verse 10 says, verse 11 is where it talks about the olive leaf. Verse 11 ends by saying, Noah knew the waters had what? Subsided from the earth. You've got, really things are happening quicker now. Verse 12 says he waited another week, another 7 days, and then he sent the dove. Now this time the dove does not return. And I thought I'd just mention this. The raven never returned. Why would the raven not return at all? Well, maybe it died. Maybe, though, ravens are carrion eaters. So maybe it's found something to eat. Although that's been a long time.
The devil ran the two birds.
Well, maybe, but the dove being a vegetarian or being not a carrion eater, I should say, is coming back. Well, finally, it finds enough purchase that it does not return.
I suppose if there were only two ravens on the boat, it would have had to have lived somewhere else.
Yeah, well, that's true. Good point, good point. It's got to be out there, another raven to find it, maybe. Yes, sir.
There's seven, or what? The birds
are... Well, the raven, seven clean animals. I don't think a raven's considered clean.
I wouldn't think so.
No, so then it's just a pair.
It's a carrion eater, so it's not clean.
Mm-hmm. So do we not think the animals are reproducing on the...
Well, and that's the case too. I didn't think about it that way. Maybe you have more ravens by this point. I'll say I don't know either way. The text doesn't tell us either way that they are or not. Maybe they are. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen birds floating on a piece of wood, you know, 1,000 miles from anywhere.
Yeah, and I imagine that's what old ravens doing. But I'm guessing there. But okay, so the dove is gone and it's not coming back, and so at this point, there's enough land for that dove to find purchase. And so in verse 13, I want to go there. So verse 13 tells us in the 600th year and first 601st year. So first year of what?
Noah's life.
Exactly. He got on the ark how old?
600.
He's getting off the ark at 601. In the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. And so it's at this point that he's able to come out. God calls them out in verse 15 and following. And so they begin the laborious task of not only coming off themselves, but they've got to set all of those animals free. And just imagine the world that these animals and Noah are coming off the ark to. It's not the same earth. It's not the same environment that they were used to. They've got to find new ways to survive. And this kind of plays in later to some important information with man and beast. So he brings them all out. Verse 18 says, Noah went out and his sons and his son's wife with him. And then all the beasts, every creeping thing, and every bird, and everything that moves on the earth went out by families from the ark. I do find it interesting. You have that same kind of order that they came onto the ark with. It's the same order you see that same kind of order as they come off the ark. And so they come off, and I don't know if they disperse immediately or how that works, but they come down off the ark. What's the very first thing Noah does? He wants to worship God. And what's interesting to me is, where does he get this information from? The text never tells us how he knows how to build an ark or what it... He's not told what... The text never tells us how he knew what to offer, how to offer it. I'm assuming that was something that was handed down by the patriarchs. His father taught him and so on. But it's something that he had remembered. And as soon as he came off, he established the altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal. This is another interesting thing. How do we know what a clean animal is versus an unclean animal? How do we know that?
Leviticus.
What?
The Bible says it.
Where does it say it?
The old law.
Do you notice, do we have an old law?
Not yet.
I find that fascinating, right? This was something, so when you think about the old law, that was not the establishment of what was clean and unclean. That was something that man had been told by God prior. So that was a knowledge that was just incorporated into the law, did not become established with the law. It was something that was already there, and Noah knew it and knew what was and what was not. There's some other things that we see like that, like with marriage and some other things that God had taught man that he knew prior to the law that were just incorporated into it. The text tells us in verse 21, what's God's reaction?
It was pleasing. He smelled.
And, you know, I was thinking about this. You know, Lisa was cooking some bacon yesterday. I love the smell of bacon. I don't know if you do or not. Man, that's a pleasant smell to me. You want to whet my appetite. That's how you do it, or one of the ways. I love the smell of bacon. I get some of the sense that God's appetite's not being wet, but that sense of pleasure is there as he sees his man doing what naturally what was a righteous act, which was to say, thank you, God. Thank you. Thank you for delivering myself and my family. For allowing me to come through this. And God is very pleased. And then God makes a covenant, doesn't he? You think of a covenant. A covenant is what? We've mentioned this before. It's an agreement between two parties. Who's God's covenant with here? Who is God making a covenant with in this particular text?
Noah and his family.
No. Somewhat. What's that?
Man.
I think it's even bigger than that. What's that?
Creation.
All creation. Right? This is a covenant that he makes not just with man, but this is a covenant he's making with all of his creation. And what is the covenant? Go to verse 21. And the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma. The Lord said in his heart. Now notice how this is a reaction to Noah's faithful service. God makes this covenant upon smelling the sweet aroma. He says, I will never again curse the ground because of man. For the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. It's a sad commentary about humankind, isn't it? Neither will I ever strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. Is God going to bring any kind of flood like he did this time? No, he makes a promise. I won't do that. It seems like to me he's going even further. God will not destroy the earth again until when? To the end, the very end. But God's not going to just stop time like this again. That he will allow things to have its full fulfillment of time. And what's the sign of the promise?
Rainbow.
The rainbow. Now, I found this interesting. I know sometimes I've heard people express the idea that before the flood, there was rain had never occurred. I don't know that the text teaches that anywhere. I don't know of that. I've heard that, but it's something I've never seen in the text where it says that it had never rained before. And if it had rained, had there been rainbows before? I think it quite possibly could have been rainbows. I don't necessarily mean, I don't think, in the Hebrew doesn't necessarily imply that it was that God began using rainbows at this point. I know that some of the translations have the word set, but that word used there for set doesn't necessarily imply that it is the beginning of it. But it may more mean or imply the idea that God gave the rainbow a new meaning and emphasis. That the rainbow at the end of rain became a promise that you'll never see what you've seen here. Now, of course, what God is not promising is that there'll never be a flood again. That's not the promise. What's the promise?
Never to destroy.
What?
Never destroy the world.
Yeah, destruction of all things. Yeah, I was looking for this. So the word in the Hebrew here for set in verse 13 in chapter 9 doesn't necessarily imply the idea of God put it into place like as though the rainbow had not existed prior, but it may more mean the idea of a point, that God took this thing and appointed it as a symbol of my promise. Go ahead.
Right. Yeah, I guess I always figured that God just changed the laws and refreshed a little bit. So.
And it's possible. What I'm saying is it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. It could be, but I think if we tried to be too hard fast one way or the other, I don't think the text lends us to a hard fast decision whether there were rainbows before or not. The important part isn't the rainbow, is it? What's the significant part?
The covenant between
God and mankind and all creation. That's the significant part. God said, I'm going to make a promise. And this is one of those covenants, interestingly enough, I know I'm out of time, but this is one of those covenants where it's not conditional. Did you see any condition God put? No, he's just simply saying, I will not do it. I think that's interesting too. Because almost every other time I can think of, there's always a condition involved. With the nation of Israel, it was conditional. Abraham doesn't seem, I can't remember, is that a conditional? I don't remember that being a conditional promise, but it's very, very few times that you see it, an unconditional promise by God. But this is one of those.
The new covenant's conditional.
It is conditional. It is absolutely. Right? It's conditional on our faith. If we respond in faith, then he'll bless us. But here, with the rainbow, that's not it's not like that. So I found that interesting. All right, so we got a little bit into chapter 9. I want to go back and talk about the shedding of blood because in my understanding, that's really the kind of the starter toward what God did with the flood. And I'll try to explain that. And I brought that up before, but I want to go back in verse 5 and following. It gets in this idea of God puts a judgment on murder. And you notice that in verse 6, he says, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for he is God. For God made man in his own image. So you notice that very, very kind of harsh judgment on anyone who would commit murder. And so we'll go more into that next week. Any questions before we finish up?
You don't need to be listening to that veil. You need to just keep on open.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, y'all.
Roger. Oh no.
So that means execution by the lions then would be a long way. I mean, it's
well, yeah, that's a good point. We know the Babylonians weren't particularly interested in God's law most of the time. Thank you all. We'll end here and pick up next week. Thank you all.